Next case for argument this morning is Racine against the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Mr. Isaacson.
Good morning, Your Honor. The reason that we're here is to ask the panel of judges to extend Treasury Reg 1.83-382 to include not only company debt, but also to include third-party debt. Let me explain how these transactions worked. In this particular case, what happened is Gail Racine exercised her non-qualified stock options. She reported on her W-2 additional wages of $1.9 million. The company took a deduction of $1.9 million. Now, with non-qualified stock options, there's a very high government subsidy to the corporations when they can take a $1.9 million deduction in a case such as this from the exercise of employee stock options. And the only way that they're able to take that...
I don't understand what the subsidy is. The stock option, when it's exercised, is treated as wage compensation, I understand. And wages are deductible to the corporation and taxable to the employee. Anything out of the ordinary about that?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the deduction of the corporation is a government subsidy. Now,
it's no different from the treatment of any other wages. Is the deductibility of wages to corporations a subsidy from the government?
Deductibility of wages, Your Honor, is not a subsidy. The deductibility of an ordinary deduction from the exercise of non-qualified stock options is a subsidy, Your Honor.
Just nothing turns on it, but I just don't understand the economics of this proposition.
Well, let me...
$1.9 million dilutes the other investors. The other investors are worse off for it by the exact amount of the difference. It's just the same as wages from the perspective of the other investors.
Actually, it's very different from wages from the perspective of the other investors, because the other investors actually contribute capital to the corporation, or they purchase the stock on the third market to purchase these. Let me explain why.
Nothing turns on this, but your understanding of corporate economics is different from mine. Hey, just go ahead.
No, Your Honor, I've read many of your treatises, and
that would account for you bringing in more books there than your opponent did. He's written a lot of treatises on this subject.
Well, are you Judge Easterbrook?
Yes, he's probably written more than I've read. So.
Well, let me explain what the purpose of the regulations is and why this is a corporate subsidy is essentially on the...
I don't want to spend much of your time on this because I don't think anything turns on it from the tax perspective. I won't stop you.
Okay, please. The reason is that the corporation cannot obtain a deduction unless they somehow find a way for the person to pay for the exercise of their incentive stock options. And so in order to obtain a corporate deduction, what these corporations would do is they would go around and set up relationships with the broker-dealer community. That broker-dealer community would in turn finance the exercise of the employee stock options. Corporation gets the benefit of a deduction. What we have in this case is we have an intrinsic relationship between the corporations and the broker-dealer community. And then let's
you
also...
You say they're an extension of the corporation, in effect?
Yes, Your
Isn't
Honor.
The corporation somehow retains something in that stock?
Well, there are two ways that the relationship between the corporations and the broker-dealers benefit. Number one, the employees have an indirect benefit that's attributable to the employee relationship, and this is taxed under Section 83. And the purpose of the 1.83-382 regs are to tax that relationship or to tax that indirect benefit where the employee can obtain what is virtually a risk-free loan in order to exercise their stock options.
It seemed that your concern was really retaining the ability to take capital gains. I mean, I didn't exactly understand it, but I thought that must be the problem, because if you have to exercise the option through the broker, then you've got complete control of it. And the company does not have. So what is there something about capital gains filtered into this that is a concern?
Is that
the reason that they do this kind of a transaction rather than just exercise the option with the corporation, borrow the money somewhere else and pay them off?
The reason that what we're saying is that the exercise that they should pay tax is ordinary income on the exercise, and then if they haven't put any of their own capital at risk, they should also pay ordinary tax on the sale of the transaction. And that's the purpose of the regulations. It's so that if the share's value goes up, the government gets a benefit, and then in exchange for that, if the share values go down, the purpose of the regulation is to give the taxpayer a benefit.
But that's at the time the option is exercised, isn't it?
It's at the time the option is exercised, but the regulations continue the requirement that the gain or loss be treated as ordinary until the person puts their own funds at risk.
Mm. I must say I don't understand that either. The only reason you're here is that your client's funds were at risk. That is, your client, option having been exercised, was at risk of a decline in the stock's price in the market.
No, Your Honor. In this case, the broker-dealer took the risk. The client assumed no risk.
Look. Throughout your brief, you're treating risk as equivalent to risk to my client's other assets. But if I invest $2 million in the stock market, I have $2 million at risk, even if the rest of my assets are in a trust and can never be reached. $2 million is at risk here from the get-go. And the argument you're making is essentially that the tax should be set up in such a way that if the stock declines, the taxpayer gets full credit for the decline, and if the stock goes up, the client can take the full gain. But, of course, that just shows that everything is at risk.
Well, that's in terms of the transaction being at risk, it's the terms of the loan agreement that make the transaction virtually riskless to the clients. And the reason for that is there's a collateral requirement of 1.35% of the loan amount. And so let's assume that
You're not dealing with what I just said. I have $2 million. I invested in the stock market, and I invested in a way that if the price falls to zero, none of my other assets will ever be levied upon. I still have $2 million at risk because I can lose the whole $2 million. The alternative, let me put it another way, the alternative for your client, as soon as she exercised the option, was to sell all of this stock and buy a painting. Right? And when the price went down in the market, she lost the ability to sell the stock, take the profit, and invest it in something else. It was not only at risk, she actually suffered a capital loss.
In this transaction, had the value of the shares gone up, the government should have the right to tax the increase as ordinary, and it's because of the way that the loan was structured. If the value dropped, let's assume that the value of the shares was at 100.
Let me ask you, do you know whether other people who have transactions like this voluntarily pay tax at the ordinary income rate if their stock appreciates?
That's been the holding on many of the courts where the person exercises through employer debt.
Yeah, but this is not employer debt. This is a margin loan from a broker. So my question is, do you know whether other people who buy the stock using margin loan from a broker pay tax at the ordinary income rate if the stock goes up?
Well, according to the regulations, the regulations do not distinguish company from third-party debt. And so if the regulations are followed, it should not make a difference whether the debt is company or third-party.
It doesn't address my question.
If I know of other...
Do you have any data on whether people who structure their transactions like this pay tax on appreciation at the ordinary income rate?
According to the Treasury regulations, they're supposed to. And I represent the taxpayer, not the government, so that data is not available, Your Honor. But on the loan transaction, let's assume that, that the value of the collateral is at 100. Or I'm sorry, that the loan is value is at 100, but the value of the collateral is let's say, at 150 at the time of exercise.
You're talking about the margin loan now?
Right, the margin loan. Well, what happens if the value drops down below 135? Then the brokerage house has to sell the sale, has to just go ahead and sell the shares before they're ever liable for a deficiency. And so the consequence of the transaction is that the employee is able to exercise the stock options virtually without placing any of his own capital at risk. Then on the other side, the company, in order to put the ability to exercise in the hands of the employees, what the companies have been actively doing is negotiating with different broker dealers, some of whom are captive broker dealers, to give the employees a loan. And so the company has the benefit by doing this that they're able to maximize their tax deductions through the exercise of stock options. And at the same time, for the employee, the financing is truly an indirect benefit of the employment relationship. And that's the reason that we're arguing, Your Honor, that these transactions do fall within the ambit of Treasury Reg 1.83-3A2.
Because it benefits the company, then you're saying it shouldn't injure, I guess, the employee.
Well, it's an indirect benefit of the employment relationship, and
well, that, with whom? Who benefit to whom?
The employees benefit from the ability to obtain virtually risk-free financing.
Well, that's not what happened, though.
Well,
once they pledge the stock to secure the margin loan, that isn't risk-free.
Well, it's risk-free until after the margin calls, unless they are in fact.
It's not risk-free. I mean, it's risk not if there's a margin call potential, it's not risk-free.
Under the economic benefit test, in this transaction, what happened was the shares dropped down. The company sold the shares, and so there's virtually no possibility.
Meaning
that
the brokerage company sold.
But right, the brokerage company sold, and so there's no.
And that's to cover their own, whatever you want to call it.
And to cover the employee, and so it's risk. Yeah. It's practically the way the loan was structured. It's practically risk-free to
both. It's risk-free to the broker because it's going to sell when it gets below a value above the value of the stock and gives it the ability to bail out before it goes under, before its loan goes into a negative.
Right. And
that doesn't do any good for the one that owns the stock.
It does do good for the employee because it acts as a virtual stop loss, so that it
protects him from having to come up with money from somewhere else.
Right, Your Honor. And that's our argument. And if we look at the history of the regulations, they've defined the debt that is tied into this regulation in terms of not liable for all or substantially all of the debt. And in this case, because of those provisions, they're certainly not liable for all of the debt. And that is what the test is. The test was written in the regulations to define the debt
as broadly. I don't understand that either. How are they not liable for the debt?
It's because
the debt is secured. That is, the broker has, through the stock, the means of collecting the liability, whether Racine writes a check or not. But how does that make Racine not liable for the debt?
Well, it's liable for all of the debt.
Racine is liable for all of the debt.
The reason is that there's a built-in stop-loss provision in the loan agreement that requires the shares to be sold above a substantial equity cushion.
It doesn't require the shares be sold. It entitles the broker to sell the shares. It's a right, not a duty. One reason why it's written as a right, not a duty, is because the market may be illiquid and the broker may be unable to sell the shares.
In the contract, the brokerage houses also have the right to monitor the equity requirements, and if they deem the shares to be more volatile, they have the right to also raise the
equity
requirement.
Not the duty. It's a big difference in law between a right and a duty.
Well, in this case, I think you're going to what could have happened, but I think what actually happened in this case is that they went ahead and sold the shares, and I think that right is sufficient to protect the employee against loss.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Ms. Oppenheimer.
The issue that's raised in this case has been before numerous courts. Three appellate courts have rejected the same argument that is being made here under virtually identical.
It's very unusual to see the Commissioner of Internal Revenue agreeing with the Ninth Circuit. Shouldn't that give us pause? Don't touch the microphone, please.
I cannot possibly answer that question, Your Honor, and be diplomatic.
Well, two other circuits agree with them, so.
Yes, the Fifth Circuit agrees with them, and the Federal Circuit also agrees with them. There's several lower court decisions on this. The Ninth Circuit has described taxpayers' position in this case as nonsense. The Fifth Circuit has described the lower court's decision in this case as compelling. Virtually every argument in this case favors the government. Basically, the regulation provides that the exercise of an option is taxable to the taxpayer when the taxpayer acquires the beneficial incidence of ownership. There can be no question but that Racine acquired the beneficial incidence of ownership in this case. She had the right to receive dividends. She had the right to vote the stock. She had the right to sell the stock. Indeed, she sold 2,000 shares of stock when the stock was declining in value. And she had the right to pledge the stock. In fact, she pledged the 25,000 shares of stock she acquired when she exercised the option. She pledged it to the broker. In fact, this whole transaction was treated as compensation by the employer when it issued a W-2 showing this as compensation when it required her to pay the withhold.
What are the differences between qualified and non-qualified stock options? I mean, one of them is obviously present here, which is that any capital loss on the stock proves to be not deductible beyond the $3,000 annual limit. Qualified stock options ones in which the basis is treated as the option price, the strike price, rather than the capital value at the time the option is exercised?
Well, the exercise of a qualified option, which is basically pursuant to some kind of plan, is governed by 421. They are not taxable. They are not subject to regular income tax at the time they're exercised.
Well, they're not taxable. I assume you mean the basis carries over as the strike price.
Well, let me.
And that would make a decline in capital value.
Let me finish what I was saying.
Yeah.
If it's a qualified stock option, it is only subject to the alternative minimum tax when it is exercised. It is not subject to the regular income tax when exercised. It's only subject to the alternative minimum tax. But there is a basis increase when you're dealing with a qualified stock option. I believe that the basis is increased by the amount of the alternative minimum tax so that when you go to sell it, you have a higher tax basis.
But what's obviously the underlying problem in this case is that the basis is the full market value of the stock as of the exercise, because the tax is paid on that. Which is why when the stock goes down in value that same year, it's not possible to deduct anything.
Well, what happens in this, I'm not sure I understand the question. In this case, what's treated as compensation is the difference between the basis or the difference between the option price and the fair market value of the stock. That is taxable as compensation. And so what taxpayer doesn't like in this case is that she's paid this enormous tax, and then when the value of the stock goes down, you know, of course it's not worth as much. You know, so she's paid a huge tax on something that doesn't have the value. So
she loses money, so she's paid tax more than she ends up with in the stock.
That's correct.
I guess I don't understand why they do this, but maybe there's something. I thought it had something to do with capital gains preservation. I don't understand.
Well, this has nothing to do with capital gains at all. The taxpayer, as I understand it, is trying to throw us a bone by saying if you treat it as an option, you know, it'll still be ordinary income. You know, when we put money at risk when it's sold. So it's, you know, she's trying to throw us a bone and say, see, it's still ordinary income, not capital gain. But of course,
just less ordinary.
Yeah, it's much less, you know, because the value of stock has gone down. The difference between the fair market value and the exercise price is much less. So the capital gains really has absolutely nothing to do with it. You know, when taxpayer sells the stock, in this particular case, when taxpayer sells the stock, she has a capital gain or loss, as the case might be, on the difference between her basis, which is basically...
Yes, but capital losses aren't deductible beyond $3,000 a year.
That's correct, but they do carry
out.
That's
the problem. This is a huge capital loss being suffered in the year 2000. It's not deductible unless she has other short-term capital gains to offset it against in the year 2000. She can carry it forward, but from what I understand about this transaction, she'll be carrying this forward to the end of her life.
Well, again, that is the problem that is caused by the stock market and not by the Internal Revenue Code. The statute and any change needs to come from Congress. The statute.
I'm not asking you to account for decisions made by Congress. That's as inscrutable as some of our fellow circuits. But I am trying to understand why this matters, why this fight is being had. Because a naive person would just think, look, you got gains and losses. The loss would offset against a gain, but the thing that's happening in the code is that for non-qualified stock options, you'll have to pay your full tax on the gain, and you may end up with losses that cannot be recognized effectively.
Well, I mean, that is true with any other asset. You acquire any other asset and it's worth less, you have a loss. It's not peculiar to options. It could happen to your house. You could, you know, you could borrow money to buy a house at a very high market price last year. You could, you know, be moved to a different city, sell your house at a huge loss, and you still have to pay the deficiency to the broker, to the lender. That is the nature of markets. They go up and they go down. Now, in the high-tech bubble in 2000, everyone thought there was no end to the stock market, you know, the stock market boom, and it turned out to be wrong. But that does not affect the tax consequences.
It's made a spectacular comeback, though.
Well, thank goodness for all of us.
No, I don't have a dime in the market. It's good.
The taxpayer, instead of, she could have immediately sold this stock when she acquired it, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, she could have, and she would have then had in her hand the cash representing the full market value of the stock. It was her decision
That fact is what ends the controversy here. Of course, if she'd bought something other than stock, goodness only knows what the tax treatment would have been.
Yeah.
But I was just trying to pin down why the difference between qualified and non-qualified options matters for this purpose, and you have been very helpful, because building only the AMT into the basis will essentially leave room for stock market losses to be recovered in a way that is not possible for non-qualified options.
Thank you. It's our position that the regulation has absolutely nothing to do with this case, because the regulation deals with the situation that if stock is paid for, or the regulation provides if the amount paid for the property is an indebtedness secured by the transferred property. Well, in this case, the amount paid was not an indebtedness. It was paid in cash. And for that purpose, it doesn't matter if the cash is paid out of taxpayers' own funds. It doesn't matter if it came from her rich uncle, and it doesn't matter if it came from a third-party lender. The point is that cash was paid out of the cash was paid to the employer. The employer completely parted with his interest in the property and could not get the stock back, regardless of the relationship between the taxpayer and any third party. So the regulation is totally inapplicable for that reason. Even if one was to consider the factors that are listed in the regulation, they provide additional support for the conclusion that the regulation is inapplicable. The regulations say that if the amount paid is an indebtedness, it may in substance be the same as the granting of an option, and then it lists several factors that should be considered. Those three factors, the type of property, who bore the risk of loss, and the likelihood that the purchase price of the property will all be paid, all support the government. Here, the type of property was actual shares of costs, actual shares of stock. As between the employer and the taxpayer, it was the taxpayer who bore the risk of loss. And again, whether she was able to shift the risk of loss off on someone else is entirely irrelevant, because the employer had transferred the risk of loss. And again, it not only was it likely that the purchase price of the property would be paid, but it had in fact been paid. Finally, example two was totally irrelevant to this case. As the Federal Circuit pointed out in Palahniuk, a better analogy to this case than example two is the example of real estate closing, where the taxpayer borrows money to buy a house, but yet after closing has taken place, nobody would contend that the lender owned the house, because the risk of loss has been transferred to the taxpayer, even though the collateral might be insufficient to, even though the collateral is available to satisfy the funds, the risk of loss has nevertheless been transferred to the taxpayer, and everyone considers the person who's put up a purchase money mortgage as the owner to the house. So it's our position that the decision of the court below is correct and should be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Oppenheimer. Mr. Isaacson, we exhausted your time, but we asked you a lot of questions, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Your Honor, on our opening brief on page 31, there's NASD Rule 2520, which says that the broker is required to liquidate the stock after giving a notice of deficiency. So, Your Honor, the Racines were protected against loss. The real reason that we're here is that the companies cultivated relationships with the lenders in order to maximize their deductions from non-qualified stock options. And we feel that those particular transactions should fall within the ambit of these Treasury regulations. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.